Okay, now I'm ready, so. Yep. Okay, so I guess you ready to go ahead and get started? Sure. For once, mine looks normal and good. Oh. All right, do you want to delete and start again or just roll with it? Okay. All right, let me see. I've got Audacity on one screen, and now I have my notes on the others, and I'm hosting, so here we go. Oh, shit, whatever. I'll assume it's recording. All right. Welcome to, what do we say? Do we say welcome to RTFB or welcome to read this? We say welcome to read this fucking book, right? Yeah, okay. Yes, and it's like, yes, of course we swear. We're two girls who say fuck a lot. Okay. All right, take two. Welcome to Read This Fucking Book, Episode 16, Provenance by Anne Leckie. I'm Elena. And we are here tonight to talk about the new Anne Leckie book. But first, we would like to, I don't know, catch up a bit because it's been a while since we got to have any book talk. So, Rachel, have you been reading anything else lately? Yes. Well, the only book that I've gotten into at all, other than Provenance this month, is Emily Wilson's new translation of The Odyssey, which I actually haven't even gotten into the poem other than like the little bit that I skimmed the day I got it. I'm still reading the introduction, which is pretty substantial. She's going through like multiple sort of thematic and historical aspects of it. And I'm actually super excited about this for multiple reasons. I mean, in the first place, I've never actually read the unabridged Odyssey. I've read excerpts from it. And this is the first translation by a woman, by a female scholar, which just kind of blows my mind that it's 2017 and that is the case. But there it is. And I don't know. I really liked an interview that I saw with her. I'm wanting to sound like on Vox or Vice or something like that. Just kind of discussing like how she felt, like almost like this weird sort of outsider, translating kind of one of the pillars of Western manhood as a woman. And, you know, just the way she discussed like the choices she was making and the sort of way she went with how to present the poetry and some of the themes. I thought it sounded like she had a really good balance of both keeping that kind of outside perspective, a little bit uncomfortable with the text, but also not trying to be radical with it and not like trying to have an agenda with it. So I don't know, it seemed like it would be a really interesting balance. And from aside from that, just like the first few lines of the poem, I think I skimmed about like 2 pages. It's fucking good poetry, and I'm really excited to get into it. So. Yeah, I'm happy to keep you updated, and I don't know, it's weird because I just had this when I saw that I was like, it's time for me to read something smart again. Like I've spent a long time since college mostly reading books for fun, and it's not that they can't be smart and that you can't like break them down and talk about them, but it just really hit me. I'm like, no, I want something like meaty and scholarly and I don't know, English majorish. So. Right. Yeah, and I actually hadn't even thought about how well thematically like a translation of a traditionally masculine text by a woman kind of ties in with like the whole ethos of of Anne Leckie's writing, just because I don't think that she has like a strong agenda in the sense of having a particular point of view, but she does have an agenda of I want you to like think about these things in a way that maybe you hadn't, and think about like the implications of gender and language and things like that. And so I didn't even realize, but it totally ties into to the book that we're here to talk about. With that said, Provenance is a new book. It came out in late September of 2017, so it's now been out like essentially 2 months. And so it is too recent to have been nominated for anything, although it is getting lots of critical praise and acclaim and recommendations. I haven't seen it marked as hitting any bestseller lists, but that was also kind of just a cursory Google search, so I could be wrong that it hasn't. And of course, our loyal listeners might remember this name from episodes 4 and 4.5, where we discussed the Ancillary Justice trilogy. We're pretty unabashed Leckie fangirls in these parts, but that's neither here nor there. If the book is awesome or not awesome, we're going to talk about that. So, Rachel, what the heck is this book about? Yeah, this would be an example of like the Liberty Bell, or an original copy of the United States Constitution would be like important vestiges, and something like an invitation to a White House ball would be a less important vestige. Means Yes. I saw someone describe it as like plot-wise, it's a cozy mystery in space, and I was like, huh, not how I would have like redacted the plot, but I can see the argument for it. It's not entirely wrong. Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, it's just, in the sense that Ingray is not someone who normally like is involved with murders or solving them, but yet she is, because she's the person that finds the body, like completely entwined with it and with the politics of it for various reasons. And I guess we should probably talk about the characters. I think you did a good job touching on Ingray. I mean, she is the unequivocal protagonist. The book is told third person limited from her point of view. So we really don't get anyone else's perspective other than through what they say and do to Ingray. I don't know, is there anything else that really needs to be said about Pallad Buddrakum Garl Kett? Because he's such an opaque character. Like it's Well, I mean, he is definitely like it shows that he both grew up in a political family where obviously he was trained from a young age, like how to control your face and your voice and like project what you want other people to see. But also that he went through, I mean, basically that he's been through the hard times that give you kind of the internal conviction to, if you need to sell that persona, like it is absolute. Like you just find that place inside yourself where you believe it with everything that you are, and like nobody's going to question it. I actually, like for me, one of the best moments of the novel was realizing along with Ingray that he had lied to her, that he actually is Pallad, and she had fallen for it when he said, "I'm not. They made a mistake. I don't know who you're talking about." Like that was golden. And I don't know. I think, yeah. Yeah, like I think that's a testament to Leckie's skill with like how it's subtle, but it's so you are so deep in Ingray's point of view. Because it is the third person, and so you feel like there's a little more like I guess distance between you and her as like the reader, but then you realize like there's not, you literally are only seeing through her eyes. It's very well done. Well, okay, so speaking of her mother, I think possibly my favorite thing about the Natano is that she is only referred to by her title, and it always has the in front of it. Like, that's, it's such a, it's just, it's so perfect. I don't know, Venetano. Like, every time, Venetano. Like, but that, I mean, it does. Yes. Yeah, like, it's so very much a title, but it's also, like, it is who her mother is. And, like, that, I mean, it's a good way to say a lot about her character, that even within her family, she doesn't want to be called by her name. She doesn't want her children to call her, you know, or to speak about her like an individual. It's always like by her title, the head of the house, the head of this political, you know, faction or whatever, you know, however you'd want to break it down. I believe Ingrid does call her mother. So it's not that she wants her children to call her by the title, but when they refer to her, it's, you know, it's not as an individual, it's as Venetano, like that, the entity that she, the political entity that she is her identity, even to her own children. And yeah. Right. I would say it's just it's an idea that she's pushing. It's not an agenda, but she's pushing an idea, you know. And that's maybe a more neutral way to say it. Yeah, funny story about that. You actually went and looked up what provenance means, and included a dictionary definition. So for anybody who might have, you know, any doubt, the place of origin or earliest known history of something, secondary definition, origin, source, place of origin, that includes the beginning of something's existence, something's origin, a record of ownership of a work of art or antique used as a guide to authenticity or quality, and... I actually had no idea what this word meant, because it's a word that I learned by reading and that I only had from context clues, and I thought I understood, so I never looked up. And I actually thought that it meant kind of like windfall or unexpected gift. And, you know, so, and it's possible that there is a meaning. I looked at dictionary.com. They didn't have a second definition or a second entry for it. So maybe like the Oxford English Dictionary would. But I just was like, wow, I really had no idea what that word meant. And I've been misusing it since I learned it probably 20 years ago. That's marvelous. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's indicative of the fact that you have training like in that field, you know. For me, I like my crossing of paths with things like this is working in academic libraries. Libraries refer to them as ephemera. And they're actually, you know, are like, they're a pain in the ass to catalog. So there actually are processes for describing this kind of ephemera or vestige from an event. It's, you know, in library world, it tends to be things like posters or letters or invitations, or, I mean, it's exactly the same sort of stuff. At least like the minor vestiges that, that Danach or Dana Chow, whatever, the brother liked to collect. And so that just sort of like tickled my fancy. It's like, oh, I have a brushing like familiarity with this concept. I spent a couple years as a lowly library tech in acquisitions. I didn't get to actually interact with such wonders. I was simply told about them in training. You know, that's for the special light, like the Louisiana collection, or, you know, the fancy collection that only the bibliographer who ordered it gets to touch the record, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the lineage, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think for me, like one of my favorite aspects, just in terms of cultural commentary, was the interaction with people from other systems that basically tell Ingray, people outside of Way laugh at us for our vestiges and how like easily disproved disprovable they are. Like they can be so easily like authenticated or discredited if you actually apply like the technology and the knowledge that's out there that, you know, people just don't, they don't, it's like they don't want to, you know, like their culture reveres them so much. They would rather believe the convenient lie we just happened to find this, you know, box up in the attic right before elections. And it has this really important, you know, vestige in it. Oh, look at us donating it, you know? Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think for me, like the obvious example coming to mind is, you know, the people that were buried, like the way the pharaohs were buried with, you know, all of their gold and, you know, wine and oils and things around them, because, you know, the understanding was that's what they would take with them into the underworld and the afterlife, and they, you know, needed to have all those things. And we sort of look at that and like we're like, yeah, that's ridiculous, but that was right. Exactly. So to us that wasn't like, you know, desecrating their afterlife, because we don't believe that that actually happened. Yeah. Um, Yeah, the rest of us have seen enough Brendan Fraser movies that we don't know. Yes, I have a report from my book club, which coincidentally read this, that he was unanimously the favorite character. Yeah, they were like, can we just have a whole book about Tick? Like, he was great. Yeah, I mean, he definitely had some damn the man kind of impulses. I mean, I took a lot of it to be that he was kind, in some ways he was a lost soul. Like, he had fled, he intentionally rejected, but at this, in anger and the moves that he made to escape from being part of the, Gek culture and controlled by the Gek, meant that he left his home world. He left everyone he had ever known and loved, and essentially, like, set out alone in the universe. And he, regardless of how they met, he did, like, connect with Ingray, like, and with Girl. He knew that she was in some ways kind of a babe in the woods, and good-hearted, despite, like, having questionable, ideas that she was trying to execute. And who knows, what he really, like, what he and Geralt talked about, or what he saw there. But when you find someone that you connect with, like, it's kind of like, I guess, the idea of the family that you choose. And so I think he decided that he was going to choose them, and that that they were his friends. And maybe he didn't realize it at first, and he was like, let him go, and I was like, no, actually, I need to come back. I need to see what they're doing and what if they're okay. And I don't know, like, that was my take on his motivation, is that basically he was choosing them, and he was choosing, like, the friendship and the connection, because who else did he have? He had his spider mechs. He didn't have friends. He didn't have his family he could go back to. Like, he was, alone. And so, yeah. Oh, for sure. Oh, Esway Parkland. Yep. I got one from the reading I went to, A Vestige of October 1st, 2017, at Book People in Austin. And it's A Visit to Esway Parkland. So yeah, that was yeah. Like, and it was so well done, because I'm sure there were a few people who had managed to, like, pick the book up and read it before, like, they went to the talk, and probably before Comic-Con, for the most part, people like were buying it there or hadn't had a chance to read it yet. And so it was like, I don't know what this is, but that's cool. And then like you get into reading it and you're like, holy shit, this is super cool. I love it. I love it so much. Yes. And I know it was real. because that's the thing, is like some of them weren't faked, you know, like some of them were actually real, and that's why people were willing to believe that to believe it, because, you know, like there did have to be an original copy of that document at some point, or there did have to be, you know, some bell that rang in the first like meeting of the assembly after the debt to Tyr had been paid and they were finally like free to form their own constitution and government, you know, all these things. And so like it's that idea that the best lie has a grain of truth, you know? And so, yeah. Right. A pickling jar. Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, they weren't intending it to be anything important. It was simply like what they had at the time. This is what they had at hand, and so they used it. But then it kind of became part of like the mythos of their culture, and suddenly took this, you know, took on this like vast importance that, you know, it never would have had. Yes. 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 Right. Yeah, well, that's actually interesting because, you know, in reality, you don't like you. Like so much of history is written after the fact. I mean, like we do this honestly with our personal lives, you know, not just like our cultural history, but like it's more obvious on our cultural history, but like we choose the narrative, like we choose like to say this is what I'm going to focus on, and these five events are what I'm going to say are important and things that I'm going to, you know, string together to make a story out of. But when you're a kid, you don't know like who the important players are going to be. You don't know who's going to be like political or like invent something or like make first contact with an alien civilization or, you know, anything like that, that, you know, so you don't keep the things from your peer group because you don't know if they're going to matter. And like, you can't keep everything, you know. Hey, baby. Why aren't you in bed? Where's Mimi?
Oh, she's up there.
She's up there?
Yeah.
Okay.
But
well,
I was sad.
You were sad? Why were you sad?
Because I just needed you.
Oh, you just needed me?
Yeah.
Oh, baby.
And why did I have my computer on?
I have my computer on because I'm recording the things that I am saying to Aunt Rachel about this book that we just read.
What kind of book?
This book, the one about outer space. So can you do me a favor, baby boy?
Yeah.
Can you go back upstairs and go lay down and go to bed? Go night-night?
No, I'm going to go watch.
Okay, well, you can go watch something.
Oh, I'm going to watch right here.
Nope, that's not acceptable. Because I know you. I know you're not going to be able to resist talking. You need to go back upstairs, please. Thank you, sir. As long as you're not making noise, baby. But I would like you to go upstairs and go see Mimi.
No, I'm not going to go way up there.
Okay. The other question is, where the fuck is my mom? Like, why did she... Why did she let him come downstairs? No, I mean, as long as he's not, like... actively needing me or making noise, it's cool. He's like, literally, he's on the staircase, like watching. I guess he wants to listen to the conversation. I don't know. There may be my child in the background making fart noises. I'm sorry. I tried. Yeah. So yeah, anyway, you don't know like what's going to be important later because you haven't had the space and the time to figure out like what the narrative is. And so, you know, it's almost like accidental, the things that get preserved and that somebody just happened to like have in a drawer somewhere, like these letters or holiday postcards from a friend who turned out to, you know, be the next Natano or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely not something that I've deeply examined, I guess, at, like, the meta level. I mean, I recently, like, have come face-to-face with, like, a drawer full of, like, old letters and postcards and things like that. And it was interesting because, you know, for me to go through it, because at 34, I have a very different curating system than I did when I was 20, which is probably the last time I opened that drawer. And... you know, I honestly tossed 2/3 of it. I was very proud of myself for being willing to like let all of that go. And so maybe I'll regret it someday. Maybe I won't, but it's done. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, they're part of the treaty, and that, you know, the treaty governs all of them, but it's what prevents the Presker from just taking over everything. And so, which they absolutely could. And so that's why everybody in human space is very like flustered by the Gek when they show up, and then when they divert from their planned itinerary, because like they have to, they have to appease them. It's kind of like with in the ancillary books with Translator Zia, like everybody's bending over backwards to appease her because like they can't possibly like offend like the Preskur. They can't like, so in this case, like they can't offend the Gek. They have to let them do exactly what they want as long as they're not like actively breaking the treaty. So it doesn't matter, like. Yeah. Right. Yes. Yeah, the Gek. Oh my gosh, the Gek interference was, just the Gek in general, was one of my favorite parts of this book. I think, yes, well, one of the things that Leki does, like, masterfully is she presents this, like, weird alternate point of view, and she makes it make sense and yet be so fucking alien at the same time, and, like, the Gek are that. Like, you can't predict them as a human because, like, they're Gekking. And, like, they don't make sense. You know, they have their own motivations and their own, you know, sort of reason for what they're doing. But it doesn't make sense to us. And, you know, then when the ambassador... Like, because we think of the ambassador, you know, as probably, like, this very important personage and, you know, would be, like, aloof. And then, like, what the fuck is she doing, like, personally following around Ingray, who's, yes, from a prominent political family, but also kind of a nobody, you know, and, like, breaking into her house and, like, screaming at her. Like, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, like chasing this random, like, you know, person who may or may not have, like, run away from Gek society. Like, why is the ambassador to the Preskur and humanity, like, chasing a ship thief? Like, really? Like, really? Yeah. To swim down. Yeah. 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 Like, actually, let me see if I can find it again, because I wanted to read some of that section. I thought it was just really really beautiful. I did it, agreed the ambassador. I did a wrong thing, but if I had not done it, Tik Uasin would have not survived swimming down. If I had allowed him to swim down, he would be dead. I did the thing I did so that at least he could be alive and in the world. But then he stole ships and left the world. It was like him to do such a thing. It was not like Gek to do such a thing. He would not have survived swimming down. No, he would not. Silence. Then, his mother grieved. My clutchmate grieved. What can live outside the world? There are creatures that live outside the world, but they must be creatures of endless sorrow and pain and death. The conclave before, I went and did what was needed and returned to the world. I did not want to be outside the world at all, but to keep the aliens away, I must do so. I returned to the world as quickly as could be. I thought to do so again this time, but we saw our ship, and I thought to myself that Tik Uasin might be there. and it might be that I could bring him back, and he would not be any longer in endless pain and suffering, because he would be in the world again, and his mother would cease to grieve. Batik Uwasin was always headstrong. Always. From a larva, he was headstrong. Perhaps I am headstrong as well. A bit. And I think that, like, that passage to me, like, it captures, like, the Gek perspective so well, because, like, you can tell that they have a very definite point of view about, like, what they consider to be the world and important, and, like, the rest of the universe is like, really, fuck you. Just stay away from us. That's all we want. This is our world. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, by far, and I don't know, I guess it also, I hate to say the word humanizes, but it makes them relatable, because it shows, like, all of the erraticism in the Gek's behavior is actually driven by emotion. It's driven by this, like, emotional sort of desperation to make it right, and or at the very least to make sure that he's okay, you know, that he's not in pain and suffering and death in the beyond the world, you know, where he is, that he's actually, like, okay. And, you know, yeah, I mean, just love can be suffocating. Like, it doesn't, it can be given with the best of intentions and still do harm. And that's, I don't know, kind of like the joy and the sorrow of a family. You know, I just, yes. Yeah. 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 My favorite character. Yes. I think, I think you might have, like, related to her on a more personal level than I did, but I adored her. Like, even from the first, like, time she shows up, and it's, like, with Ingray and the golden orchid representative, and she's just like, I don't understand what the problem is. Like, why did you call me? Why did you interrupt my dinner? Like, fuck you. Yes. So she was another character that was kind of suffering this like outsider status, and basically her family was in disgrace, and so the greatest shame that her family could be given, under the pretense of this is an honor, and, you know, for her personally as well, is being the ambassador to the Gek, which is, it sounds really important, but she's like, there's nothing to do, like, the treaty's, like, in effect, so basically, yes. Right. Yeah. Yes. Yes, she's stuck out there all alone and yeah, like has no one to be with in her culture, no one to understand, and the food's terrible. Like it sounds pretty awful. Yes. Right. Yeah, also hilarious. Yes. Yeah. It might be like a little topically like, amusing, like, oh, poor ambassador like complaining about the terrible food. Like it's topically like almost funny. Yes. Well, and also because of course you can't help but like compare the ambassador to like the Rajai ambassador to the GEC with, of course, our favorite like Presger translators, because they're essentially like ambassadors for the Presger. And so they also have that weird, like, we're trying to understand your culture and failing miserably kind of perspective. Like, Tib and Vori's different because she's basically like, I don't understand and I don't give a shit. I'm not even trying. And that's so very, like, Radchai of her to have that attitude. But no, you're completely right. It's a deep context kind of humor. Because, like, I'm sitting here, like, that's so Radchai. But, like, if you don't know what that means, like you don't like, and it's not something that you can really like encapsulate. It's like you have this emergent context from having read the other books, or you don't. I definitely have the impression that I got more out of this book than I would have, like if this was my first book that I picked up from her. I think I would have enjoyed it regardless, but I really loved it. Like I had because like the gosh, like she has this richness to the worlds that she creates, or like there's all these things that like she doesn't really directly explain. They're just there. And, regardless of whether she even knows like what they mean, she, but like, to the culture and the people there that they matter. They mean something. They're, you know, and so it feels, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, either way, whether she does or whether she doesn't, you know, she knows, like, your imagination's going to, like, fill in something, at least fill in, like, a meaning there, like, a depth of just detail that makes the worlds just feel real. And, like, they do have, you know, this multiplicity of point of views and... Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 Ironically, this just occurred to me. The fact that the society is Way and they're on Way Station, I don't know, like Way Station is like a kind of stopping point on, you know, on a journey. It's a, like, I don't know, that just, that's in some ways having all these like kind of displaced dispossessed individuals like together, like that's exactly where they are. They're on a way station while they try and figure out like, where is my life going, like what am I doing. Yeah. It's men, women, Neiman. Yeah. Yeah, it's EM air. Like it makes sense. Yeah. The way the rats do. Yeah, like it's a different way of framing the questioning our binary gender society. Like the rats doesn't recognize gender. This definitely recognizes gender, but it's a more complex and or nuanced recognition than what our modern American culture has. Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, going back to the title of the book, I mean, in a lot of ways, this is a very traditional coming of age novel. So, like, the title of the book could, in fact, refer to Ingrid's like origin story as how she comes to be like her full adult self. Like, even though she chose a long time ago, like that she was a she. And that her name was Ingray. I mean, she has this talk with Talcris that she, like as Talcris was saying, like, how did you know? And Ingray was like, I just chose, like, I just did it. And like, because we're seeing like her point of view so strongly and so deeply, like we see all the ways that she feels almost like an imposter, like she's doing these actions and she doesn't necessarily know her own convictions and she doesn't necessarily know like why she like what she even wants. And it's I mean, it can be like a subtle process, or it can be like a really obvious and painful process that's sort of like coming into like your own identity and your own self. And that's what this process, that's what the story does for Ingray, is it does finally like bring her into like that full knowledge of this is who I am and this is what I want and this is what I don't want. And I don't know, I just the yeah. Right. Yeah, but then by the time she did, she actually like had that sort of sense of, no, this is what I want and this is who I am. So she, yeah, so she was very like, once she like had her naming and like became herself, like she was very like comfortable in that. Whereas Ingray did her. Right. Yeah. Okay. I think it was actually at that point the mechs were being controlled by the wait like the way station security, but they hadn't figured out how to not tip their hands. So I think that was the people controlling the mechs that were pretending to be so I mean let's just assume that like anybody listening to this has read the fucking book. Like they were pretending to be the Omchem people that had been controlling the mechs on behalf of Captain. somewhere. Maybe. So you know, maybe I don't. But I don't know whether he was. You know what? It was a little bit ambiguous, and I was reading the end very quickly because I was just so focused on like what happened, and I didn't. I was like, oh, okay, it was somebody on like the security team and or Tick like doing it. Like I don't care. Like you know what's going on here. So I'm actually not sure. Yeah. Right. Yeah. yeah, that was kind of unexpected. Yeah. Well, I mean, it certainly like saved her, you know, some trouble from like having to explain what happened or, you know, also like having to worry about what the new things were going to be until that got settled. You know, I'm sure it was a relief. And even if like rationally, you know, like that they were fake and didn't matter. Like she also has the discussion with herself, like, well, but they've been on display for the last 300 years, so even if they were fake, they still have like now become like weighted with significance and history of their own, you know, aside from their origin. Yeah, they've become. And becoming yourself. Oh my God, those were yes. Yeah, so like my the comment I made in the notes was that this is a perfect example of like of a meme. And this is something that like the older I get and the more I guess I know about different time periods and different cultures, the more I see like the threads of this in literature and across like time and space is basically like all human culture is a meme. Like we translate different or transmit different ideas and people like pick up on them and run with them and like you get something like 30 years out of context and nobody like gets what the context was, you know? And so I'm like my comment was this is like the fucked up translations that Ingres like l bad like limited little auto translator is offering for the Omkhamsian language like are almost like you can't really like every now and then you can kind of understand what it means, but they're gibberish. And I was like, this is Google Translate. Like this is yeah, like this is a joke that like everybody in our generation completely like understands. But like take this book 30 years ago, like that's meaningless. I mean, you understand. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You know, so like it's not that it would be an incomprehensible joke, but it wouldn't have like the layer of cultural reference that it has to someone reading it right now in 2017 who has ever tried to translate anything with Google. Right. Yes. Yeah. Well, like I think the first moment where it comes up where you know that like the translation device is lying, fiddlesticks, swore Cap Commander Hatkibon. Like, you know that when they just blew up a spider mech that might or might not have been the Gek ambassador, she didn't fucking say fiddlesticks. Okay? Like, that's obvious from the get-go. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we haven't really like directly touched on this, but you have to consider anytime you've got like a seriously deep, like third person limited point of view, that you might be dealing with an unreliable narrator. And like, you know, Ingray sees herself as almost like broken. Certainly she sees herself as like marginally incompetent and like not anything special, and she spends her entire life comparing herself to her brother and her and you know perhaps the Natano as well, and seeing only the ways that she isn't like them and that she fails to be like that, and so she has like no real sense of her own strengths or value. And you know, you have various other characters who will say things to her that like are completely divergent from that perspective. It's like, you always have a plan. I knew you would make a bold move. You know, like, but she sees herself as like this. Right, exactly. You know, but she sees herself almost like as this, yeah, like this victim that things happen to, you know, and oh man, I'm still like flipping pages. Right. Yes. But yet if you actually like look at the book, so much of what happens is in fact directed by Ingray and the choices that she makes to counter like what she sees happening to her. But she like because she's not viewing it that way, like it takes you most of the way through the book as the reader for you to realize, you know, how, yeah. Yes, yeah. Right. Oh. Yeah, like, well, but Breck wasn't trying to like change society. She was gonna fuck somebody up. Like that was her like entire goal. Like, I'm a fuck a bitch up. You and me, and not my and I, this one's for Lieutenant On. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah, no, I mean, that's certainly very true. And I mean, I think the choice that Ingray makes at the end sort of bears that out, where she's like, no, I kind of just want to go home and like get back to living. Dude, right? How do you pass up the chance to like roll around with a Gek to the fucking conclave? Oh my god. Oh, fuck that. She could make Tib and Vori like her best friend for life by taking on like sufficient supplies on way station of like human goods to get them through the next like 6 years. Come on. But I finally found one of the translations. It took me a lot of flipping. Finally, said Commander Hat Caban, as another Federacy mech trundled into the room. Good quick work. Specified several captive offer a turnip ship. Time is finite. Additional only these to exit. Search attribute exhaustive. And it's just like, wait, what? Like, it almost makes sense, but it doesn't. Yeah. 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 And she has no idea. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I feel like she's meant to be a character that has to grow on you, you know? Like, that you... I mean, like, I guess I found her kind of, like, hapless and endearing at first. I was like, oh, girl. I feel... Like, the moment when Pallad's like, I'm not Pallad Boudricum, and she believes him. Like, that was the moment that, like, I was like, oh, girl... You're touching my heart here, because I'm fucking gullible. I can be gullible like that too. Like, as smart as I think I am, and as like well as I think I read people, I can be fucking gullible. And if somebody's like looking me in the eye and like giving me absolute conviction I'm not Pallad Boudricum, I'm gonna be like, fuck, you're not Pallad Boudricum. What do I do now? Well, it was yeah, she was, like, gonna tempt him with revenge and, like, any money that they got out of it. And hope that... But... Yeah, she had no backup plan. She had no plan. But she was, like, just gonna hope that, like, he felt enough, you know, obligation or gratitude to her for, you know, getting him out that he would help and, like, let her, like, in on anything he did. Mm-hmm. Well, so I feel like I've covered about everything that I wanted to talk about. I know that you had some things to say about Cherry simply because you've now seen enough interviews with Leckie for her to have confirmed that as an influence. So I don't know if there's anything that you needed or wanted to say about that, but here's your moment. Oh, okay. It is definitely your turn to recommend because I demanded that we read this book because I knew I wasn't going to fucking read two books in the same month and I was already reading this one. So yeah, it's your turn to recommend. All right. Okay, well, I mean, I know, Well, I know this much. Foreigner is it's at this point a classic, and it's sort of, it's one of those books that I've seen on the bookstore shelf for, probably as long as I've been perusing the science fiction section. So, which at this point is like 20 years, something like that. Well, you're saying all of these things with with hesitance in your voice, and I'm like, yeah. Ah, yeah, this will, I think it'll be fun for both of us, so I look forward to it. Fingers crossed that I love it. And we'll have to work out a numbering scheme if we do end up reading all 19. Episode 17.2. 17.3. I do not have time to read 19 books between now and January. Yeah. Me too. All right, cool. Well, Excellent, excellent talk and deconstruction, and we'll holler at you soon.